Support for WVIK comes from Kathleen Collins at the Dragonfly in Bettendorf. Using both conventional and alternative counseling methods for empowerment to help create change for individuals and couples. More information is at KathleenCollinsCounseling.com.
You're listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a presentation of WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR.
Hi, everyone. This is Robin Johnson, and welcome back to another edition of the Best of Heartland Politics, a radio show I began in 2014 that's now a regular show and podcast on WVIK Public Radio in the Quad Cities. To commemorate the 60th anniversary of the day the music died in 2019, I interviewed Lawrence Limmer, author of The Day the Music Died, The Last Tour of Buddy Holly, The Big Bopper, and Ritchie Valens. I found the book to be full of information I was previously unaware of that I wanted to share with our listeners. For example, I didn't know how Iowa-centric the Winter Dance Party tour was. One-third of the scheduled stops were in Iowa. Limmer also talks about the grueling pace of the tour, which occurred in the cold of winter and traveled along many two-lane roads via bus. Those conditions are what led to the fateful decision among some to fly to the next destination. We also get into the tremendous influence Buddy Holly had on music and culture that lasts to this day. I hope you enjoyed this edition of the Best of Heartland Politics. It's not just for music lovers. With Lawrence Limmer talking about Buddy Holly and the day the music died. Good morning, everybody, and welcome back to Heartland Politics. This is your host, Robin Johnson, and it was 60 years ago this past week that marked the day the music died. Of course, for those of an older generation, we know that that refers to the tragic plane crash near Clear Lake, Iowa, that took the lives of three up-and-coming and famous rock and roll stars, Buddy Holly, Ritchie Valens, and the Big Bopper, J.P. Richardson, as well as the pilot, Roger Peterson. Today, we're going to look back at the events leading up to that day, the roots of rock and roll music, and the legacy of rock and roll on American culture, and also why that day still we still commemorate that day and why it's still important. My guest today wrote a book back in 1997 called The Day the Music Died, the Last Tour of Buddy Holly, The Big Bopper, and Ritchie Valens. He's Larry Limmer. He's a Des Moines-based writer with 24 years of experience at the Des Moines Register, and he actually worked for a short time right here in Burlington at the Hawkeye. Larry, thanks for coming on the show.
Yeah, glad to be here.
Well, I really enjoyed the book, and I would recommend it to folks. It really, you go through life and you think you know a lot about things, and then you read up, and there's so much more to learn. And I thought this was a really, really information-packed book. But kind of start off by just leading us through what led you to want to write about this topic.
Yeah, it's real interesting. I was 13 years old when the crash happened and just getting into rock and roll music like all my friends were, too. And I was living in Council Bluffs, Iowa at the time. And, of course, when the plane went down, we were all shocked at the news. But I was even more surprised. I didn't know where Clear Lake, Iowa was, even though I'd lived in Iowa. And I certainly had no idea why singers of that stature, we all knew who those singers were, you know, why they would be in a small plane in Iowa. So there was a lot of questions that I had, even as a young kid. But the story pretty much disappeared from most of the press after a couple of days, and you never really heard much more about it. So I really didn't think a whole lot more about it either until in the mid-70s, I was growing up and working at a newspaper, and I picked up an edition of Crawdaddy magazine, and they had a cover story, Who Killed Buddy Holly? And that got my attention. And so I went and I read the story, and turned out it was all fiction. Somebody had just taken the basic facts of the crash and had built a story around it. And they had a lot of names and a lot of detail that I'd never heard before. And, of course, working at the newspaper, I realized I could check this stuff out myself. And when I found out that it was all fiction in that article, they did have a photo accompanying it that showed the CAB report. So it was investigated by the federal government, and I'd never heard about that either. So I figured that'd be a good place to start.
Well, it's it really led to I think you know, shining a light on something that, again, a lot of people thought and maybe knew a little bit about, but not a lot. But the thing that really struck me was this winter dance party tour. Reading through this, I mean, you think that touring is glamorous and great accommodations, and it was anything but that.
Yeah, that's certainly the case with this tour. That's how a lot of people in those days sold records. You had to go out and tour, and you didn't go out and tour in arenas. I mean, there weren't such places, really. But the upper Midwest was dotted with ballrooms. There were lots of ballrooms, and they were always looking for acts to fill that. And that's how the tour came about. Buddy Holly had split from his manager and was trying to get established himself, you know, running his own career for the first time. And so he hooked up with General Artists Corporation. They put together a tour, which of all places in the middle of winter in the upper Midwest, not the most desirable place to go. And they kind of pieced the tour together that they found the major ballrooms that they could get booked into. But most ballrooms want the big acts on the weekends, and that leaves the weeknights without things. So they were kind of adding, almost as they went, they were adding acts, you know, adding stops on the tour.
Yeah, it was 24 cities in 24 days.
That's what the plan was. Of course, mm-hmm. they only got about half through before the accident happened. Mm-hmm. The tour continued, mm-hmm. you know, even after that accident, even that night they went on.
In your book, you describe the weather, and it sounds like the weather we've had this winter in the month of January. It was cold and just brutal conditions, and the buses weren't the most reliable either, were they?
No, the tour actually was booked out of Chicago. That was where they all gathered and started, so I don't know who the bus outfit that booked it was, but they had buses break down three or four times on that tour, just on the 10 or 12 days they were out. And they were constantly having to get new buses to come and pick them up. And they ended up on basically school buses a lot of the time.
And they had heating problems. And it shows in the schedule, and you've got a nice map in the book of how it really didn't go, the tour didn't go in a logical geographic order. They would zig and zag and 400-600 mile jaunts to get to where they were going. Sometimes they got in real late.
Yeah, a lot of times they traveled overnight. They didn't spend a lot of nights in hotels, and if they did, they were just small hotels in small towns a lot of times. When they put the tour together, like I say, they had to grab dates where they were available, and the Clear Lake event was added late in the whole scheme of things, so that's why they had to zig and zag so much.
Yeah, the chapter, you called it the tour from hell, and it sounded like it, with the weather and the bus accommodations and then the zigzagging of the travel. But what I found really interesting, and I had no idea, but Iowa was really where the focus of this tour was. I counted up of the original planned 24 cities, eight of them, one-third of them were in Iowa.
Yeah. They did. They had a lot of them in Iowa. And, of course, Iowa, like I say, they had a lot of ballrooms and theaters that they played in, and it was just a real good spot.
Apparently, there was a lot of demand for rock and roll music, which was in we'll talk about where rock and roll and its history was here in a minute. But it was obviously very popular in a lot of the small towns across the Midwest.
Yeah, and you could see why. I mean, they had a lot of really big names for the time. You know, for 1959, these were really big acts. Buddy Holly, you had Ritchie Valens and the Big Bopper, who were killed. But you also had Dion and the Belmonts on that tour. Mm-hmm. And they were basically as big a headliner as Buddy Holly was at that time.
And the size went from – and it also hit, four places in Illinois, Chicago, Springfield, Peoria, which was to be on Valentine's Day in Spring Valley, which is a really small town. And in Iowa, they were Davenport, Fort Dodge, Clear Lake, Des Moines, Sioux City, Cedar Rapids, Waterloo, Dubuque. Those were the originally scheduled ones. But the smallest town was up in Minnesota. I mean, that was another one that was kind of out of the way and a town of 5,600, as I recall.
Yeah, which one was that? Was that Montevideo?
Montevideo.
Or Mankato? Yeah, there were several small towns up there, and Duluth wasn't really. Yeah, I mean, and that's way up there. for that time of year. And that was just a couple of nights before they actually got to Clear Lake that they were crossing over to Wisconsin, up in northern Wisconsin. That's where they had their worst bus breakdown. It broke down in the middle of the country in the middle of the night, and they were burning newspapers in the aisles to keep warm. And that's where they lost their drummer. Their drummer had figured, well, the best thing to do is put on a lot of socks and everything like that to keep his feet warm on this frigid night. And he ended up, his feet sweat so much they got frostbite and they had to hospitalize him.
That was that the one, Larry, where it was near where the Dillinger gang hit out at Little Bohemia?
Right. Mm-hmm.
That was an interesting historical fact that I enjoyed reading about in the book.
And not only that, it was a weekend, and they had to get to their next stop. They ended up actually having to cancel an afternoon show, and they went on to Green Bay. But some people caught a bus. Some people got on the train. I mean, it was a real mess.
Yeah. It's just, you think that, again, and then two-lane roads where, you know, there's another factor to it. So it was a punishing tour, and that was one part of the book again that I learned something new about. So the events take us up to that fateful night at Clear Lake, and of course there've been different stories go around about how the different people who were on the plane were chosen. What did you find that you reported in the book?
Well, I found that there were a lot of stories out there that weren't true, and really I haven't heard all of the stories, but I do know that I think it was Waylon Jennings told me that if everybody had been on that plane that claimed to have a seat on that plane, they would have needed a 747. Because there were lots of people, Paul Anka, and Dion still, I think, insists that he had one of the seats on that plane, and I don't think he actually did, although they may have discussed it at some point. But it was basically Buddy Holly and his two bandmates were going to have the seats, and the Big Bopper was sick. He was fighting a cold, and he talked one of the bandmates into giving it up. That would have been Tommy or Waylon. And so he got Waylon's seat. Waylon Jennings was the bass player for Buddy Holly's band on that tour. A lot of people didn't know that. But the other guy, Tommy Alsup, he was just getting ready to get into the car to go to the airport after the show. And Richie Valens says, well, let's just flip a coin. I really want to go. I'm not handling this cold very well. And they flipped a coin. And so that's how Richie got the seat just as they were headed to the airport.
Yeah. You talk a lot about the pilot who's often, well, has always been overlooked in this, and he's got a story to tell too, which I think you dedicated the book to the pilot. Roger Peterson was his name, and talk a little bit about his background and because I think that's important that he was a victim in this crash as well, obviously.
Well, that's true, and I started this book when I was working at the Council Bluffs newspaper in the mid-70s, and I gave it up after a while. I was having a lot of trouble tracking down Richie Valens' family. That was a big hang-up at that point, and I kind of gave it up while my family was growing, and I had moved from Council Bluffs to the Des Moines Register, and it was kind of late in the 80s when a friend of mine had been covering, they have these dances at the Surf Ballroom every year, and the Register would always do stories. It was really getting hard for him to come up with new stories every year. And then the Richie Valens family started coming to Des Moines for March of Dimes dances, and he knew that I was the hang-up in my book project, and so he said, why don't you take it over for a while? And so that's the way I sold it to my editors at the Register was, you know, Roger Peterson was the only Iowan that was involved in this, really, and so his story had never been told, so they gave me a year to kind of cover the Buddy Holly, Clear Lake, Richie Valens beat, and I went up when they did the monument dedication. I met Roger Peterson's family, I met his widow, and I met the Valens family, so that door was open, and that's when I was able to finish the book. But I spent some time in the farmhouse where Roger Peterson was raised. His family was still alive at the time up by Alta, Iowa. And it was just fascinating to hear about these kids growing up in their early 50s. A lot of these kids couldn't drive. They weren't old enough to drive cars to school, but they could fly airplanes to school. And there were three or four classmates of his, and this was a small school. They probably didn't have more than 30 or 40 students, but they would have three or four planes parked outside the school for these kids that commuted to school by plane.
Interesting. I was surprised too, and I guess here again, I didn't know. The Peoria Journal Star paper just had a story commemorating the day the music died last Sunday, and they talked about how, you know, the show went on. They just got some more people to come in and play, and they did play Valentine's Day in Peoria.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and they came back. Actually, one of the more poignant parts of my research was finding the kid finding the guy who replaced Buddy Holly on that tour, because they did need somebody to fill that role. Because, mm-hmm. I mean, he had these other people. The drummer was still in the hospital. They had to fill in on the drums, and he had Waylon playing bass, and he had Tommy also playing lead guitar. But Buddy Holly was gone, and he did most of the singing for that group. Well, for a couple of days, Waylon took over the singing. He sang the songs, and like I said, they went on that night in Fargo, in Moorhead, Minnesota. But they called up a kid from West Texas named Ronnie Smith, who had played in a band with the drummer Carl Bunch, and he was known as a very good rockabilly type singer. He'd be a good one to take over for Buddy on the lead. And so they got him up here, and he joined the tour here in Des Moines at the Valair Ballroom, and he went on and finished the tour, and they thought he was going to be a big star. He did some recording at the same studio that Buddy Holly recorded at there down in Clovis, New Mexico, and had a few records that did fairly well. But then he got involved with glue sniffing and some other things, and they locked him up in a mental hospital in Texas, and he committed suicide down there in 1962. So that was really a sad story, and I met his family down in Dallas. But, you know, that's the show must go on mentality. That's what they preached in those days.
Yeah. The Peoria article talked about how Waylon really wanted to go to the funeral, of Buddy Holly's funeral, his friends, and he couldn't because, what you said, the show must go on. And
that's right.
There was a lot of different talk, too, about the actual cause. Different rumors and stories. What was the actual cause of the crash?
Well, I think the CAB got it right in their report. I think it was basically pilot error. Roger Peterson was not qualified to fly on instruments, but this was an overcast night. It was obviously darkness, and he had to rely on instruments, even though he hadn't passed the test. He had actually failed the test a couple of times. But the plane that he was flying in was different than the plane he'd been tested in, and the gyroscope worked in exactly the opposite direction. And it's hard for me to visualize this, but pilots who have flown in these overcast conditions where there's snow on the ground and the overcast sky, you can't tell up from down, and your body doesn't give you the clues you need. And I think he thought he was climbing and he was actually going into the ground. Now, there were lots and lots of rumors about what caused the crash, and this was one of the things that was kind of hard to sort out, some of these rumors, because people had been telling these stories for 30 or 40 years by the time I heard them, and they were pretty well entrenched in what they were saying, but a lot of them weren't true. There were people saying there was a fight in the cockpit, and they could actually see it from the road when the plane flew overhead and all this kind of stuff. But the very first thing that I heard, the very first person that I interviewed in person in the Mason City Clear Lake area said, well, what about the gun? And I said, well, I haven't heard anything about the gun. So that was one of the real hot rumors up there, because they had found a gun in the field where the plane crashed. They found a gun in that field the next spring when they were getting ready to plant. And it turns out it was Buddy Holly's gun. So there are a lot of people thinking, well, maybe somebody shot somebody on the plane, which doesn't make a whole lot of sense either. But
you're listening to Heartland Politics on KBURAM-FM, Burlington, Iowa. This is your host, Robin Johnson, and my guest today is Larry Lamer, who wrote a really good book called The Day the Music Died, The Last Tour of Buddy Holly, the Big Bopper, and Richie Valens. It came out in 1997. Larry had 24 years of experience at the Des Moines Register, 40 years experience total writing, editing, and he worked for a brief time here in Burlington. We've been talking about, of course, the events leading up to the tragic crash near Clear Lake that took the lives of three rock and roll icons. I think it's interesting, you know, in the broader sense. My show's about politics, but I also, as listeners know, I talk a lot about American culture and how important culture is to politics. We look back at this every year. February 3rd comes up, and it's looked back upon for our older generation. But how would you put this in terms of why this might be important for younger people to commemorate and remember?
Yeah, it's kind of hard for people to realize, unless you were there in the 50s, the people that spent their childhood in the 50s and maybe came of age in the 60s, how different the times were. I mean, we were really in boom times, and I don't think people really recognize how good the economy and everything was for U.S. kids at that time. I mean, we just came out of World War II in the 40s, and a lot of the other countries were trying to rebuild. I mean, Europe was in a shambles, and Japan, we dropped two atomic bombs over there. And they just couldn't provide the world with the stuff that America could. So economically, we were just driving everything in the world. And for kids like me that were growing up in that era, we didn't know any different, but everything was really going pretty good. And then with the music changing so much, with TV coming in the late 40s and early 50s, a lot of radio stations had gotten rid, the networks were getting out of radio and getting into television. That opened the door to independent radio stations, and they were able to play music that wasn't available during the war. And certainly there was a big war between ASCAP and BMI on the licensing organizations. And BMI basically was the rock and roll side of things. And all of these new independent radio stations were looking for music, and these BMI record labels were willing to provide it. It was music by people more like us. It wasn't, you know, the big band era was gone.
Mm-hmm. It was, you describe it in 56, 57, it was exploding at the time. Teens buying records, it was the birth of rock and roll, but it was controversial too, because you talked about how that music was banned on some radio stations, and Boston actually banned rock and roll shows.
Yeah, that happened a lot in that era, but you have to remember that the media was in the hands of people who were like my parents, who had grown up in the 20s and 30s, and they had no use for rock and roll. And that's one reason why after that plane crash there wasn't much written about it, except the teen press might have had a little bit about it. And the teen press was also pretty big in those days, but it was pretty much just a PR thing. They didn't do any real journalism. So, you know, we didn't hear anything more about it at that time. And the adults in my life, at least, were not particularly enamored of rock and roll.
Well, you talked about how they came on, Buddy Holly came along just after Elvis. And I've always heard debates, including people in my family who lived through that period, aunts and all, that Buddy Holly would have been bigger than Elvis. I don't know. Do you have an opinion on that?
Yeah, I get asked that question a lot, and I really don't. I think he was headed more towards the business side of music. I think he was ready to open a studio and maybe turn to songwriting. That was one of the real interesting things about those three people that were killed on that crash. They were all so different. I mean, the Big Bopper really just wanted to own a radio station and be a songwriter, and Ritchie Valens was just coming up. I mean, he was just 17 years old, and he was a superstar to the Hispanic community in the Los Angeles area where he was from, and who knows where he might have gone. And he certainly influenced a lot of really good music from that area.
I thought it was interesting. You talked about how Buddy Holly almost seemed to have greater influence in Britain than the U.S. and the enormous influence that Buddy Holly had on the Beatles.
Yeah, that's really funny. I mean, a lot of early rock and rollers were huge over there, and blues music was huge over in England. It was like almost a different planet from what it was in the States.
And I had to add this in, too, because this was another little fact that I wasn't aware of. The title, That'll Be the Day, was taken from a John Wayne movie, the line of John Wayne and the Searchers. That was something else I wasn't aware of.
Yeah.
What I have one more question here before we wrap up, but do you think because this is generational that the influence of rock and roll may start to wane with the decline of the baby boom generation getting older and all? And I guess it's part of that, the broader legacy of that date and rock and roll on America. What do you see, I guess, big picture, why that's important, why we commemorate it, and what the lasting legacy is?
Yeah, I kind of wonder about that myself, just because modern music is so much different. I mean, if you watch the Grammy Awards, it's so different than the music that I grew up with. And, of course, the music I grew up with was different than the music my parents grew up with. But my wife and I are both senior citizens now, and we go to places where senior citizens go. And they're still playing my parents' music. They're not playing music of our generation. You don't hear Little Richard or Fats Domino or Buddy Holly, Elvis Presley music. You hear big band era music. I think they just think that old people listen to that kind of music. They don't listen to rock and roll.
Well, for young people, I think if I was asked, I guess I would say this is where a lot of it started, that you could draw the line between that era and the acts today. As odd as that may seem, they are connected throughout history with the beginnings of rock and roll back in that era. Let me end up here. Just you had mentioned to me that you're working on another book that's going to be very interesting for folks of that era. Go ahead and share what that book is about and when it might be published.
Yeah, the book is called Bandstand Land, and it's about American bandstand, as you might expect, and it's subtitled "How Dancing Teenagers Took Over America and How Dick Clark Took Over Rock and Roll." And this has been another fascinating area for me to look into. I've always wondered how Dick Clark became so big and Alan Freed just faded from the scene right after the Payola hearings of 1959. So I started looking into that, and it's a pretty good story. And it's going to be published, I think, in April. We haven't got a date yet, but they're working on the cover now, and it's going to be published by Sunbury Press from Pennsylvania. And I hope to do a book launch from Philadelphia. The book is pretty much about the Philadelphia years of American bandstand.
Okay, great. I'll be looking for it and have you back on to talk about that.
Oh, great.
Well, Larry Lamer has been our guest today on Heartland Politics, a little different type of topic, but I've sure enjoyed it. Because, again, another aspect of this story is really a lot about Iowa history, and Iowa being kind of the center of this tour and more than just a footnote in the history of rock and roll music. The book is called The Day the Music Died, The Last Tour of Buddy Holly, The Big Bopper, and Richie Valens. I highly recommend it. And Larry, thanks for being on. I really enjoyed this.
Yeah, thanks, Robin. Been great.